All right, so I'm going first, or okay, perfect. All right, so I want to start up first, of course, by saying my thank yous as well to Philippe, to Patrick, to all of you for being here. And I want to offer a small apology if you hear in the background at Sydney right now at 7 at night. So I have here at my home office, and I have a 4-year-old who's quite rambunctious, and a 15-week-old who doesn't understand being quiet yet, which is good though. They're both very charming. The 4-year-old might try to make an appearance at some point in time. So I want to talk to you all about just on cue. I want to talk to you all about my first book. See it here, and I have a PowerPoint, and so I can share that if people would prefer. I think that's probably best, actually. So I'll go ahead and share that, and I'll slide show it. All right, can we see? Okay,
Yes.
perfect. So
Wonderful.
this is the book, Sport in Physical Culture in Occupied France: Authoritarianism, Agency, and Everyday Life. It's out from Manchester University Press. If it interests you, please ask your university to buy it, or email me and I can send you whatever you want, because it's very expensive. So it's better to reach out to me, and I very happily send you what you want. So what I wanted to do today is just introduce my project a bit, give you a bit of an in-depth examination into one association to try to illustrate some of the ideas. And that's where I'll try to cut back a little bit, and then offer some general conclusions along the line of what Patrick was talking about. How can sport help us better understand the historiography of Vichy? And as I mentioned before, if at any time you have any questions or a small group, please just stop me to say, "Oh, let clarify this," or "What do you mean here?" Basically, this project started from a small question, which was, why did the number of registered soccer players during Vichy go up instead of going down? I found that out when I was in graduate school. It wasn't my discovery, it's just something I discovered for myself. And I wondered why that happened, because that seems so counter to what I thought I understood about the historiography of the Vichy regime, especially the Anglo-American historiography, the Anglophone historiography of the regime and of everyday life in the Vichy period. So I investigated sport as a kind of counterpoint, or a way of better understanding the regime. And what I discovered was that sport offered an opportunity for ordinary people to learn how to survive, or maybe even thrive in some ways during the war and the post-war. And it relied on people being creative, innovative in response to the penuries and the difficulties of both the Vichy regime, but also the German occupation. And so I make the argument, and again, I'm not the first person to have made this point, and there's certainly a number of French historians who have made this point, and it hasn't done much to enter into the Anglophone literature. That the Vichy regime is actually a kind of golden age for sport and physical culture, during which physical education and sports explode in popularity and importance. Sportsmen and women affiliated with a variety of organizations, local multi-sport clubs, professional teams, schools, company sides, police and military societies, summer camps. I can go on. on weekend mornings, late on Wednesdays and Thursdays, they would compete. They traveled hundreds of miles, or I should say to you all, hundreds of kilometers, to don sometimes tattered socks or worn shoes, stretched into their swimsuits and their jerseys. And they took fields, arenas, to pools across France in front of significant crowds, and they played the games that they loved. And when you start looking into the newspapers in France, instead of the historiographic literature in the US, you find this everywhere. So, for example, you can see in May 1943 that 40,000 fans get together at the Stade de Colombe to watch the Coupe de France finals. And this, it just seems strange when you read the literature on the Second World War in English, because it makes you wonder, how could so many people have had the inclination, the permission, the stamina, the time to attend these professional soccer matches during the occupation. Why would they go? And so this was my question. Why, you know, why do we have this meteoric rise of licensees in soccer? Why do we have this meteoric rise in some ways in the number of, briefly, in the number of attendees for sporting matches, this growth in other sports as well? This expansion of physical culture was clearly a central feature of life during the occupation of France. It was a central feature of the social and civic landscape of the country, and it was something that was largely missing from the Anglophone literature. So I don't think that I won't belabor this point, because my sense is with this audience, probably there's a lot of people that already know this material. So I'm not going to go into too much detail, but if people want more detail about some of the specifics of Vichy's policies, we can definitely talk about that. So what I mean to suggest to all of us is that the golden age of physical culture during the Vichy period represents an opportunity to reevaluate our image of the occupation as les années noires. Popular athletic diversions seem out of place in the context of the Second World War and the German occupation, a time that most historians kind of rightly associate with extreme penury and genuine need, as well as violence and dehumanization. Indeed, studies of everyday life in wartime France rarely, this is in the Anglophone literature, rarely note the number of French people that participated in physical education and sports. The current literature on Vichy, which the Anglophone, this is the British historian Robert Gilday, refers to as the poor France position, emphasizes the devastation of France under the Germans, the complexities of interactions between the occupier and occupied, the limited number of choices possible to ordinary French people, the nuances of resistance and collaboration, especially with regard to cultural life. These are really fruitful studies. I don't mean to downplay their importance. These are incredibly important works that illuminate the complexities of life under occupation. But in their concentration on the hardships of wartime France, they don't fully capture the resilience of local actors and the diverse strategies that they used to enact change within the context of the Vichy state, the occupation, and the war. So to better understand the continued vitality, agency, and autonomy of individuals, groups, and institutions, my book examines physical cultural policies and diverse athletic practices in a number of different places, inside public schools, sporting associations, the Grand Fédération. I came to this project with that question of why the number of soccer players doubled, but I quickly found myself not constrained by that, because actually that wasn't what sport it was like in occupied France. People weren't just playing soccer, they were doing lots of things. You know, why were they out on these fields instead of, you know, waiting in line for groceries or scrounging or, you know, for coal or any of the things that really dominate our understanding of the wartime in some ways? Instead, what I find is this really vibrant social and cultural arena, mostly ignored by the Anglophone historians who, in their focus on other areas of everyday life, missed this. It's not at all an area that's limited. That's hemmed in by limitations, but in some realms, especially in sport, we see a flowering amidst this trauma of the war and occupation. I came to understand the physical culture during Vichy as two competing phenomena. One that's really well testified to in the French literature, which is the massive state investment in a policy of national regeneration, which is best exemplified by the creation of a sports bureaucracy, the Commissariat Général de l'Éducation Générale et au Sport. And if you're familiar with the work by Gay Lescaut, then you know that whole bit. But the second thing, and what most of my book actually focuses on, is the work that ordinary people did to take sports in physical culture, to organize into local sporting associations, to try to make use of that state spending in particular ways for the promotion of their own local or regional agendas. So they turn sporting spaces into arenas for individual expression, and the preservation of normality, spots to protect entrenched business interests, to provide homes for Republican institutions, as most importantly, as sites for mutual aid and assistance. In short, they use physical culture as a way to survive the occupation, to survive the Vichy regime, but even to learn to thrive. So if you were to read my book and want to read it, and again, email me, please, you'd see that it falls into kind of two major parts. The first two chapters deal with that state influence. And so the first chapter deals with the interwar, the influence of Léo Lagrange and the Popular Front, especially. The second chapter discusses Vichy's major aims, which can kind of be broken down into kind of three things: creating sports bureaucracy, the CGGS, training teachers, and providing new sporting facilities. And then the final chapters, the 3, 4, and 5, deal with this creation of physical culture in different places. Chapter 3 deals with schools. Chapter 4 deals with the Grande Fédération for the most part, and takes on, for those people who are, I don't know if anyone's interested, but if you're a big rugby leaguer, a rugby à 13 supporter, that's where I try to answer that question with rugby à 13. And chapter 5 deals with a lot of local community-based sports, and that's really done through a kind of tripartite research strategy. So I did research in Lille, in Paris, and in the area around Toulouse. And then chapter 6 tries to deal with the question of resistance and to what extent sports contributes to a culture of resistance. And I say, not very much is a bit of the not as much as you would expect, perhaps. Not at all. Not zero. I don't say zero, but I'm saying not as much as maybe you would have expected. All right. I'm kind of altering a little bit what I want to say, by the way, here, so that we, in the interest, we can have more questions and conversations. All right, so this is just to explain why I had my three regions, but since I think we all know about the zones of occupation, then it would make sense for us to not need to talk too much about why Toulouse, Lille, and Paris might be good sites. all right, so I'm just kind of skipping ahead so that I'm not repeating myself. All right. So the thing I wanted to talk to you about in a little bit of detail today is to try to illustrate that the influence of that local, and how ordinary French sporting officials, athletes, can make use of the conditions of the occupation to improve their lives. And to do that, I have to actually talk about a kind of complicated and at times politically and socially complicated example. At times you have to tell stories that other people would wish you ignored. But I'm not doing this because this is a long way of saying, like, this isn't for me about an issue of blame or not for cohabitation with the Germans, for example, but rather a question of how clubs were able to manipulate levers of power in order to achieve certain athletic and sporting objectives. All right, so I want to start with a kind of anecdote, though, and this is the maybe perhaps infamous French serial killer, Dr. Marcel Petiot, who during a cross-examination of a witness against him in his 1946 trial, asked a seemingly innocuous question, and he asked the person that he was questioning, did you not play tennis at the racing club? Now, on the face of it, this question feels kind of inoffensive, but in the context of this trial, in the context of liberated Paris, in fact, his insinuation was kind of clear and could have been considered a pretty deep insult. Petiot was making sly reference to something that at the time everyone in Paris knew, which was that from 1940 until 1944, high-ranking German officers participated in the everyday life of at the
ranks of the France.
This was a mental connection so entrenched in some people's minds in Paris that it was possible for Petiot to use the name of the club metonymically, right? In his transcript, he doesn't say, oh, you saw the Germans there. He just mentions the club, and he knows that people in the audience can make that connection for themselves. And now this accusation was a kind of ultimately unsuccessful for him, but apt defense strategy, because what Dr. Petiot was trying to do was create he was lying. He was trying to create a story by which all of his victims were actually collaborators, and therefore that his murderers were patriotic. In alleging that the person at the stand who was meant to be his next victim was a member of the racing club, what he's doing is Petiot is setting himself up as a good Frenchman and implying that his witness was a bad Frenchman deserving of death who'd collaborated with the Germans. In other ways, he's trying to couch himself within the language of resistance. This is all the way, by the way, false. None of this is true from Petiot. He is just lying. But it does raise a question of how the reputation of one of France's most prestigious sporting associations, then as now, the Racing Club de France, could fall so far as that a serial killer could use it in a trial to sully a witness against him. A closer look at the conduct of the Racing Club de France during the war demonstrates how one organization dealt with the complexities of the occupation in the Vichy state, a time when sporting associations had to deal with both French authorities and fraught social interactions with the Germans. So probably many of you know about what the Racing Club de France is. At the beginning of the occupation, it's one of the oldest and most prestigious multi-sport associations in France. It was founded in the basement of the Gare de Saint-Lazare on the 20th of April 1882 by high school students from the Lycée Condorcet. These young men were looking for a place to practice what they called athlétisme, so what I would call track and field. And their first sporting events were held in the Bois de Boulogne. And they very quickly founded their own facility there, the Croix Catalan, and it included a small track and a members-only chalet, which you can see there in the pictures. But by the start of the Second World War, it had expanded to include, for briefly in the 30s, professional soccer, rugby, swimming, basketball, hockey, tennis teams. And in terms of athletic success, there's few sporting associations that were as blessed at the time and are as blessed now as Racing Club. The club's golden years, I would say by far, in the 1930s and 40s. And in the 1930s, their teams win multiple Coupe de France tournaments, their soccer teams. More than that, it's a real important club socially within Paris as well. I've visited it to do research, and they were very nice to me, so I shouldn't speak too badly of them, and I won't. But if you know anything about the club now, is that it still has very clear links with government and with policymakers. At the time, it was a bit of a who's who of conservative French politicians, businesses, and businessmen and prominent athletes. We can think of people like Pierre de Coubertin, Jules Rimet. Their roles included lots of other famous French names, Héron, Dupont, Merlin, Ney. So it's not too hard to find members of the club who are in the Parlement. And they host an enormous number of sporting events, but also quite a large number of political events, and are frequently visited by the President of the Republic. So if you start reading their newspaper, you get a good sense of this. But probably the most celebrated activity, or one of the most celebrated activities in the 1930s and 40s of the club, was the tennis section. The club's president, Pierre Gilloux, was the former president of the Fédération Française de Tennis, and he would be the president again after the war. And they had a number of famed members, people who were members of the club or were affiliated with the club in some way, including Jean Bonhatra, who's Vichy's first sports minister, René Lacoste, who has all of my shirts that I wear when I'm going to the beach. The entrepreneurs, you know, as a textile entrepreneur, as well as a tennis player, Jacques Brugnon, Henri Cochet, these are the so-called Four Musketeers and the French Davis Cup champions from 1927 to 1933. And you just have to look at the club from above to see the kind of influence of tennis. I'm not much of a tennis player, but that's a pity. I know. Well, if I were growing up in the U.S., I certainly wouldn't be a clay court player. But the courts there are beautiful, and they obviously were. Pierre Giroux was also associated with the construction of Roland Garros. So if you are a tennis fan, which Patrick, it sounds like you are, then you definitely know Giroux. So what happens to the club during the occupation? So after the defeat of 1940, Paris and the Racing Club de France, of course, fall under the direct control in some ways of the Germans. And for the next 4 years, the club and its members became implicated in a kind of complicated and contextual web of proper and improper activities that guided everyday interaction between German occupiers, the Vichy state, and the ordinary French men and women. And the contours of these arrangements change frequently. It's very much kind of a gray. What's permissible one month might be impermissible another. What's allowed shifted on the basis of social class, gender, age of participants, time of day, place, as well as kind of recent local and international events. The often kind of thing you read in the Anglophone literature is like a man could have a drink with a German soldier at a club or bar. It's not great, but it's okay. But not in their own home or something like that. French women and German men could exchange pleasantries by a pool, but not all kinds of conversation were permissible. This is because there's an immense power discrepancy, right, between ordinary French people and German occupiers, which means that ordinary French people often have to accommodate the demands of the Germans, but in doing so, they have to be very careful not to violate the social strictures which guide proper conduct. But that could also bring to them certain advantages. And so, you know, you might think of Vercors, the Silence de la Mer, as like the principal example of really good behavior during the Vichy period. Of course, that's fictional. And more often we think of maybe business men with close personal relationships to German officers who gain a lot of new clientele. And that is swept under the rug often after the war. So you have to, it's very contextual and complicated, and people had to be careful. And so this brings us to the club. Well, in line with their general policy on providing the best amenities in Paris for their officers, occupation authorities viewed the club as an attractive opportunity for sporting activity. Per Pierre Giroux, when the Germans arrived in Paris, they were seduced by our facilities in the Bois de Boulogne, with its spacious gardens, sumptuous accommodations, and its many elegant red clay tennis courts. And within a few weeks, the Germans started to make clear to club leaders that they wanted access to the facilities of the Racing Club de France. So what's the club gonna do? And on the other hand, why don't the Germans just seize the club? If they wanna use the courts, they have the power to seize the courts. They can do what they want, right? Well, they might have done so, but in order to prevent that, President Giroux, in an attempt to forestall the requisition of the club, something which happened to a lot of sporting facilities around Paris, offered the Germans limited access and enticements. So after what he called a series of laborious and meticulous negotiations between the annual committee and the occupiers, the Germans founded their own parallel club within the racing club called the Deutsche Tennis Club Paris, and it seized partial control during certain hours of the day of 10 tennis courts and 2 locker rooms, both the men's and women's, for their sole use. But relations were always a little bit troubled. On several occasions, minor assaults to Germans' authority, including the frequent theft of German officers' private items, led to German officials to threaten to requisition the club entirely. The Germans also decided they wanted access to the pool, access to additional tennis courts on the Rue des Saussures, entry to the members-only club. Pretty soon, there was what they would call later a kind of cohabitation going on. So as every time the Germans demand something new, the annual committee gets together to decide how much they can give up. And After I wrote my book, subsequently done a little bit more research, and I found this other photo. And I want to point out, it's not, of course, just the Germans who are interested in this club. And you can see in this second image here, American officers cavorting in the pool after the liberation. So occupying armies seizing kind of access to special places inside of France is not something that was particular to the Germans. And I'm sure, although I don't have documents from this era, but I'm sure it was also somewhat fraught and complicated to invite all these uncouth Americans to tramp around. That certainly would have been my thinking. So, all right, the picture I presented so far suggests the Germans have this power, and the Racing Club de France is down here powerless to resist the demands for access. But that's not actually true. You know, club leaders weren't passive in this relationship, and they had certain cards to play. The Germans don't want to seize the club because they want access to these facilities, but they don't actually want to do the management of the facilities themselves. They don't want to be responsible for that level of day-to-day life. The unequal nature of Racing Club de France relationship with the Germans did not entail a lack of agency or power on the part of the French. In fact, rather than simply accommodating themselves to diminished role, the annual committee, the association's leaders, learned to leverage the presence of the Germans into financial success for the club and into a significant increase in the number of training facilities and luxury properties owned by the society. Pierre Gilou's successful and, by the end of the war, controversial management of this cohabitation is illustrative of how sporting associations could learn to take advantage of an extremely difficult situation. The Racing Club didn't seek out this cohabitation, but they did learn to use it to their own and temporary advantage. So what do they get? Well, in 1940, the club's finances, due to the mobilization, are largely, let's just say, not in good shape. But by 1942, the club had largely overcome these financial difficulties, in large part thanks to new fees paid by new German members of the association. I could give you some of the details of all that, but that would just be me reading a lot of large numbers. So I hope you just take my word for it. And they used this new money to increase their physical presence in not only in the Bois de Boulogne, but around the city. So I could talk about all the sites that they tried to gain access to or to purchase, but I want to focus on just two. Near the Stade de Colombes, the club purchases adjoining fields, which prevent the installation of an industrial park, which they feared would become a target for Allied bombing. So instead of factories being built on this facility, they build a new hockey field, 10 new tennis courts, 2 basketball courts, 3 volleyball courts, and a 400-meter track, which brought their holdings around the stadium to almost 200,000 additional square meters. In addition, in 1942, the club is able to purchase all the rights to Roland Garros from the other partners who had additionally had parts of that as well. And they one day hope to hold the Davis Cup on these kind of famed clay tennis courts. So just as the sole club that can do that. So here's, you see that they're able to use this money to actually significantly engage in new purchases and new rights to properties around Paris in kind of prestige locations. And they're only able to do this because of their close connections with the Vichy state and with the Germans, who are able to work with the club, these new land purchases, one of which blocks construction of a factory, can't have happened without the Vichy states and without the Germans' approval. So we can say, like, in some ways, the club grew in size because of the Germans, but we could also say maybe in spite of the Germans. It's always this attraction and push and pull. What we do know as well, however, is that the size of the club nearly doubles. It goes from around 5,000 members in the early 30s to almost 10,000 members in 1943. So just to give you a sense of how this is reflected in our tennis courts, This is something they put out in themselves in 1943. Oh, I see there's things coming into the chat. Okay. Sorry, just looking at what's at the chat. So you can see the Racing Club de France publishes this in 1943, and they're making a very affirmative case for some of the benefits of the improved financial situation of the club. The leaders of the association understood that cohabitation with the Germans would be unpopular with most of the membership, at least the old membership of the club. And they tried to sell the benefits of cohabitation to their members in this 1943 pamphlet, especially, but without actually ever saying the word German. So this pamphlet outlined for members the links between the improved financial situation and the spatial resources of the club and its cohabitation by tying together the finances of the club, their purchasing ability, and their ability to do this kind of construction. And so Pierre Gillou writes to the members of the club, and he says that in spite of the innumerable difficulties which paralyze the activity of our country, it's a great euphemism, the racing club not only subsisted, but also expanded. And again, I want to highlight, what he chose to illustrate that expansion was literal tennis courts. So he really wanted to show tennis courts. You might be wondering how the membership of the club reacts to these changes, because I'm not trying to tell this story about the club as if everyone in the club agrees, because they don't. And we can see that clearly in their spring 1944 annual general meeting. So the expansion of the Racing Club de France pleases many of the members of the association who agree with Gillou's plans to preserve and expand club life during the wartime. Some of those people, they're genuinely really concerned about the club being just taken over by the Germans. And so they're pleased that Gillou is able to defend that and that their club can continue and even grow. But there are rising complications. So in the spring of 1944, in spite of turning fortunes on the battlefield, Gillou kind of oversteps and he starts to plan for the construction of a new and contentious, what he's going to call a grand clubhouse. In Paris, near the Bois de Boulogne, in the 16th arrondissement. He meant it to be a place where the supporters of the club could gather to socialize, and he imagined that it would emulate other high-style, exclusive private clubs in the city at the time. Other hardcore supporters of the club, however, disagreed with this, and they thought it was nothing more than a kind of expensive creation of a new commercial enterprise for the club without immediate connections to sporting activities. And they drew the line at the clubhouse, and the clubhouse eventually doesn't happen. This kind of overreach illustrated the beginning of a larger rift within the club that surfaces at the end of the war. So you have to kind of read between the lines a little bit in this rapport moral that Gillou does, but Gillou starts talking about an opposition that's being born among some of the old members of the club who habitually frequent the site, and they mark their activity by a kind of hostile character, by a distemper uncommon to the normal cordial rapport that's always existed between members of the committee and the association, that they refuse to give in to the rules, and instead the club has become a place for public meetings, the pool, the restaurant, in the locker rooms, and soon on the fields. One exchanges pleasantries and objections put forward against the committee. He was particularly incensed that opponents actually circulated a petition to critique his decisions. And so he organizes a kind of counter campaign to register and address some complaints, but also to stamp down on these people. The general tenor of these complaints are that the racing club is being taken in the wrong direction. And they raise three types of objections. One, to the commercialization of the club; two, to the changing of club customs; and three, to the admission of new members of the club. But underneath all of these objections, kind of unstated, is a more important objection, which is this accommodation of the Germans. And in the interest of time, I don't want to kind of illustrate how I do that through a kind of close reading, although I'm happy to talk about it later. But basically one quote might suffice to explain all three positions, which is the quote taken from a guy, Monsieur Elbruth, who you can see here. He's the guy wearing the jaunty scarf in the top image, and he's the one who has the 12 there and running in the race. He complains about the direction that the club's being taken, and he says, "Look, we don't accept that our club will degenerate progressively into a casino. Oh, into a casino linked to commercial enterprises that derive substantial profits. And we regret to see, under the cover of financial stabilization measures, the club literally invaded and transformed into an enterprise for the construction of tennis courts and a consortium for the rental of chairs and sunbathing equipment." It's a very evocative language that he uses to try to complain about the presence of the Germans without actually ever using the word German, because this is in the spring of 1944. So instead, he says the clubs invaded and transformed into an enterprise for the construction of tennis courts, the Deutsche Tennis Club, and a consortium for the rental of chairs and sunbathing equipment. It's important to note that Heilbuth represents a kind of countercurrent within the club, but it's not the majority opinion, or if it is, it isn't the one that wins out in the day, and it isn't the one that wins out in the day after the liberation either. So the club is, of course, with the rest of Paris liberated, and if you read chapter 6 of my book, you'll see that they do a very good job of rehabilitating the reputation, aligning themselves as a kind of club of the liberation. They do things like honoring members of the club who were killed in the resistance. They fund French forces of the exterior so they can help support them as they work their way into Germany. And they produce numerous pamphlets kind of designed to bolster their resistance credentials. Hardly the only sporting association to do this. And in the context of that, you might think that these new voices who are critical of Gilles would win the day, because they would have this very powerful position from which to do so, to critique Gilles and others in the annual committee. But in fact, they aren't able to do that. And Gilles and the members of the club are now able to more openly debate the presence of the Germans. But Gilles defends himself by basically saying that these were kind of necessary, potentially indispensable changes that they made, and that he actually preserved the club. He was, in some ways, the club's shield at a time when it was necessary to avoid. I used that word. He didn't use that word, to preserve themselves from the Germans. I'm speeding up a little bit what I was trying to say, just in the interest of time, but some general conclusions then. The case of the Racing Club de France for me is particularly instructive. And I offered it here today just because it's one that has the most documentation, because of Racing Club's kind of prestigious position, because of its longevity, because of the diligence of some of their archivists. You can find out all of this just by visiting their facilities. Now, their archive is not at the Bois de Boulogne, unfortunately, and you have to go quite a bit out of town, but it's worth it. I would point out I visited other facilities. Stade Français has similar documentation about a cohabitation with the German Air Force, right? So it's hardly the only facility. And if you look, you would see that a very high number, probably more than 50% of all athletic facilities in Paris, were at one point in time occupied by the Germans for some purpose, sometimes sporting, but usually not. All right, so the case of the Racing Club de France is a kind of particularly instructive case of wartime agency. The leadership of the club entered into the occupation faced with a very fraught decision. Do they cohabitate with the Germans, or do they likely lose some, if not all, of the club's facilities? In 1940, club president Pierre Gilles makes a difficult decision to cohabitate and to work with the Deutsche Tennis Club Paris. Once the Germans were already inside the association, however, he quickly mobilizes the club's connections to make his ambitions for a larger and more influential racing club real. That was his agenda in the 1930s. He played upon the Germans' desire for more tennis facilities to fulfill his appetite for a policy of radical expansion and a transformation aimed both at the redevelopment of the association and at the mutual aid and security of his fellow club members. These changes turned the association into one of the most dynamic actors in wartime Parisian sporting life. In the run-up to the post-war, however, these decisions became a kind of political liability. By 1944, the advantages that the club enjoyed thanks to their relationships with the occupiers now also seemed to threaten its existence. So we can look at Racing Club de France, and it can complicate for us the simple idea that the war and the occupation always led to fewer choices and fewer opportunities. And instead, we can illustrate how athletes and sporting associations, like almost all French people, cleverly approached the seemingly intractable positions of the occupation, and they made the best of their situations. And I think we all know the so-called Système D. This is Système D, right? As with many other sporting associations, Racing Club de France saw opportunity in the problems of the wartime, opportunity for growth, opportunity for advancement in sporting terms. Despite the numerous demands that were placed on the association between 1939, when the French occupy it for their own military purposes, through to 1945, when the French and other Allied forces occupy it again, we can see how these particular demands could have undermined and completely destroyed the sporting association, but they provided opportunities. And these clever leaders, in a complicated and very controversial at the time way, were able to use these occupations and cohabitations to expand the business of the club, expand the properties of the club, improve quality of life for its club members. But to do so, they had to make difficult, maybe even you might think wrong choices. They had to admit the Germans into their club, alienate some of their oldest members, create a rift that boiled over in the months after the liberation. And so this is kind of illustrates a larger phenomena in my work. During the Second World War, the French government, and to a lesser extent, the German occupation forces, attempted to create a strictly regulated sports regime in occupied France. But sportsmen in schools, grand clubs, federations, small associations, reshaped the meanings both of the occupation's national revolution and the rules of the German occupier to serve their own agendas. So when we now acknowledge the power of the actors on the ground to alter the activities of the French and German governments, when we reevaluate their ability to change in really important state policy, we have to then reevaluate what we think about the nature of power and authoritarianism. So that's the kind of larger scope of my project. And I could waffle on about that for a long time, but I'm very nervous and very anxious to hear what Patrick and you all have to say. And so thank you. And I'm looking forward to talking and answering whatever questions, même en français, même en anglais, that you have to pose.